Audi.
Hello, I'm Lisa Francesca Nand, and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. We are proudly sponsored by WeCure, the leading health tourism provider in the UK. They connect patients seeking dental treatments, aesthetic procedures, and social and mental well-being with internationally accredited medical institutions in Turkey. So if you need a treatment, you might as well turn it into a relaxing holiday. And we have an exclusive offer for you, as if you book via this link I'm about to give you, they will pay for a friend, a family member, a lover, whoever, to come along with you. So visit wecure.co.uk/big travel podcast to find out more. That's wecure.co.uk/big travel podcast. Now, on to today's episode. Lem Sisse, one of the UK's most brilliant poets, was taken from his Ethiopian mother against her will at birth, and after a stinging rejection from foster parents aged 12, spent his childhood in care. He published his first book of poetry aged 17 and sold it to striking miners in Lancashire. Poetry, he says, gave him wings, and he began his travels not just around the world, but also the physical and metaphorical journey to find his birth family. With part of him always feeling like that rootless kid, he says, I'm seriously delighted to have Lem Sisse on the Big Travel Podcast.
It is a story of travel. It's a story of immigration and, you know, a story that will be familiar to a lot of people. But I think that might be a very good place to start. You know, travel was not part of your agenda as a child growing up in foster homes and care homes. So most people will know your story, I'm sure, but let's start very, very early on in 1966 with your birth, I think.
Absolutely. Well, my birth was 1967, but 1966 is when my mother flew from Ethiopia first to Greece, because there was not a direct flight from Ethiopia to London, first to Greece to Athens, then changed at Athens to London. And my father was a pilot for Ethiopian Airlines. So you could say that travel really is in my blood. I was conceived in Greece. So I was conceived on the stopover. Nobody wants to know where and when they were conceived, but I had to find out, and there's a story to that. But my mum was coming to study, just like any kind of forward-thinking culture. Travel is a part of how you learn skills, and then you bring them back to wherever it is, you know, you came from. And that was, my mother was coming to England to study and then to return to Ethiopia, which was in its heyday at that time, for certain people, you could say. The Emperor Haile Selassie was heading Ethiopia. They set up the Organization of Africa Unity, which is like the United Nations for African continents. Ethiopia was never colonized. It was occupied by the Italians for a few years, but not colonized. So it's a symbol of a kind of new Africa, really, because a lot of African countries at the time were sort of decolonizing.
I've interviewed three people from Ethiopia recently, but yes, very prominent people, and flew to Addis Ababa to record this with Ethiopian Airlines. All three people had a connection to Ethiopian Airlines, which I'm getting the impression is very significant in the country. You know, it was very part of the growing middle class. You know, we're associated, yes, with the airline. But I also got to know something about the magic and the history of Ethiopia, and it's not something I was aware of before. On the world stage, we mainly know Ethiopia due to the famine, which is now, of course, many, many years ago. And also, what I didn't realize at the time, it was more of a political famine, because Ethiopia is a beautifully green, lush, magical, magical country. And I think we'll talk about Ethiopia when you actually go to Ethiopia for the first time, because of course you know none of this when you're a young child. You are sent into the care system, and by all accounts it was pretty damn tough.
Yeah, it was tough. I do think that the first journey, the first migration a person makes is from the womb into the open air. You know, we are constantly traveling from one environment to another. My mum was put into a mother and baby home, and the social worker effectively stole me from her and gave me to foster parents and said to them, treat this child as your own. He will get her to sign the adoption papers. And so I was brought up with the Greenwood family in Lancashire. And the only travelling we did was around the northwest of England to see my grandmas and granddads, and to Scotland, to Loch Inver, to the Highlands. Most beautiful, beautiful, brutal landscape. I did love it. And then at 12 years of age, the foster parents, who'd said that they would be my mum and dad forever, put me into children's homes and never spoke to me again. And I lost everybody. My aunts and my uncles, my grandparents, the whole family. And then I was held in a series of children's homes for the next 6 years and then released at 17 and a half.
Well, why did they, because by all accounts, early on, they were good foster parents, were they? I mean, what was life like with them? And why do you think they did that, something so horrific?
That's exactly the question I asked myself for all of the rest of my childhood and a whole lot of my adulthood. I think it was connected to my foster mother's postnatal depression, to the fact they had a child, an extra child that they weren't expecting. So they had three children plus me, and I think that I was the fall guy for the family. It's not even complicated. What complicated it is that they couldn't admit that to themselves. So they had to sort of blame me. And again, I had no idea what I had done to lose everybody that I'd ever known in my life. And I still don't, you know. What does a child have to do to lose, for their parent to say, you are no longer part of us?
Did you blame yourself for a while?
Yeah. I thought it must, well, it had to have been me. I mean, it had to have been me. I didn't know what it was about me that it had to have been. But the entire idea for them was that I would feel some sense of guilt and that I would understand that it was my fault. So I spent a lot of time thinking, what did I do to make this happen? And I stole biscuits from the tin without saying please and thank you. I stayed out late with my friends. I had cigarettes. I did everything that a normal young adolescent would do. I was 12 years of age.
As an adult, you know now that was not in any way your fault.
Yeah, but I must admit to having spent like a lot of my formative years believing that must have been somehow me, you know. But then I left care and, you know, tried to manage my way through my life. And, yeah, that's me.
What was the care system like?
The care system sort of was very... was very biased against children in care, weirdly. We would be punished for doing anything wrong, but we wouldn't be congratulated for doing anything well. And it was very punishment orientated. You know, most of the kids who steal from shops, or most of the children who drink underage, or young people who run away as well. They're not kids in care, they're your kids. You know, when your child does something like smokes, something illegal, or drinks underage or something, you come together with your partner or with yourself to discuss how we're going to get through this, you know. If a child in care does it, the police are called. See, so the idea that children in care are naughty is to pretend that children are not naughty. You know, so there's like an unchallenged bias against a child that's out there in society. So to be an already traumatized child in a care system surrounded by people who actually think that you're intrinsically bad, it's quite a shocking place to be.
They don't love you as well. And I think that that's the main thing with parents, is that your kids can do horrific things, but because love them, you will more readily forgive them.
Absolutely. I mean, your child could be a murderer and you would be the one that would visit your child in a prison, you know. Love and the actions of love are all possible within the environment. By the way, I don't want to like be down on the care system or on people who've been in care, because I'm one of them, you know, and life is beautiful. And, you know, I've set things right. I've proved what I'm telling you now is true. I've taken the government to court. You know, I've received apologies for what happened, for having my mother stolen from me, from being incarcerated, imprisoned as a child illegally. I've written books and plays and I've just received my files and, you know, and I know so many incredible people who were brought up in the care system. You know, I know chief executives, musicians, heads of city councils. You know, my favourite person is a plumber from Lee. You know, he was brought up in care. He's got a wife and children, and he works and he's bought his home with them. And I look at his life and I think, you are the most successful person that I know, because I know what you went through as a child, you know. So I don't want people to feel that this system of care, which is dysfunctional in so many ways, gives way to a set of damaged, violent people, because it's not true. 97% of people in the care system have nothing to do with the judicial system. After they've left, they get on, they live their life, they try to provide a life for their children that they didn't have. And that hurts them, because they're reminded as their child grows of everything they didn't have, and yet they provide it. You know, that's the story of a hero or a heroine. And not only that, as they grow, they try to not talk about their own past, because it's so toxic that they don't want to pass it on to their own children. You know, and there is good in that and there's bad in that, actually. But it's there are so many unspoken heroes who were brought up in the care system who've gone out to make the world a better place, even if that is by having one child or holding down one relationship that they never thought they deserved.
And you turn to poetry, which isn't automatically what you imagine children of any age, any background turn to. But did you just have it in you and have the urge to write?
I wish I could bottle it and say it was this. So if you just give it to somebody, they'll be able to be that as well. I don't know where it came from. Why is one person a great cook and another one not? You know, why can one person suddenly understand numbers and think, oh, I want to go into mathematics? I don't know, there's something about numbers that I love. You could say it's a book that you gave to your child, and your child, you say, I remember when you, but there's something deeper. There's something further. It's like when the child is born, do you see in them something? Do you look and think, oh, there's a spark, or there's a this, or this is an introvert, or there's an extrovert, there's a sort of creative, outwardly creative person, there's a thinker, there's a joker. You know, I just don't know where it came from. And I'm happy, you know, I've been trying to answer this question. And I want to say, well, maybe it's because my foster father was an English teacher. Maybe, and it's not. It was sort of in me from the moment I was born, and it became visible. I think every parent must want their child's talents to become visible in their own time. You know what I mean? So even though I didn't have parents, I always knew I would become what I was. I knew I would become a poet at 12 years of age.
And by 17, you were selling poetry to striking minors. I mean, how does that even happen? What was the north of England like to a 17-year-old who decided to sell poetry to striking minors at that point?
Well, I was brought up in Lancashire and in the north. You know, I was always other. You know, I was the only sort of person of colour in a village. You know, I was... You know, and I wrote poetry, you're right, I did. I sold it to the striking miners in 1984 and 85 of Lancashire, and they bought it. You know, they bought my poems, and I paid for that book. Actually, my first book, when I was 18, I paid for it myself to the printer, who let me pay him every week. And, you know, this is really connected to this podcast, because it's because of poetry that when I left the children's homes, I had books published then by a proper publisher at 21. But even before that, it's poetry that put me on planes. It's poetry that I travelled. I never, as a child in the children's homes, I never went abroad. They never took us outside of the country. I didn't go abroad with my foster parents. I'm just realising this now. My first flight was, I think it was to Germany, and it was to perform. And it would have been in 1989, yeah. And every time I sat on a plane, I would say to myself consciously, poetry put me here. Like poetry, that thing that I was doing in the villages years earlier has put me on this flight.
How was going to Germany at that point?
Oh, it was great. Oh, my days, it was great. I thought that breakfast was cereal and milk and toast and then a fry-up, you know, which is what we do here in England, right? Like in the north of England, especially, a fry up at the weekends. And there was this breakfast food, which was meat and cheese and tomatoes and even gherkins. And it was spread out. And I just loved it. I loved it. And that this was... breakfast in mainland Europe, actually in a lot of mainland Europe, breakfast is like that. It's us here that are actually quite different. and cake, oh my days. I'm from the northwest of England. We think we know cakes, you know, Victoria's sponge. We do not know cakes. German cakes are next level. You know, the layer... This is
it's because I pulled a face. That's why, because we're looking at each other on Zoom. And I pulled a face when you said that, because I am like, I will fight the corner for British cakes until I die. You know, and I'm from the Northeast as well.
Yes.
No, I'm not. I'm from the Northwest. Where am I?
I'm from
the Northwest. Yes.
Yeah.
So even though I'm a travel writer, he doesn't know where I'm from. I will fight the corner for British cakes, Victoria sponge. You're from the land of parking, aren't you? I mean, come
on. Look, no. I love our cakeology, okay, yes. Of the Northwest. I love our cakeology. We have to remember this would have been 1989, and I think, there's been a resurgence of interest in the cake and in the British cake in particular. But it was the difference between saying, I don't know, that we have carpenters in England who, the cakes of Germany were like miniature palaces. They had like hard bits in the middle, like a thing of chocolate, a thin film of chocolate. A thin breakable bit of chocolate in the middle, and then more and more and more and more. And sorry, I just remember being very excited by the cake.
No, I totally, I do get excited by cake. And actually, this is not something I've ever thought of now, so I'm formulating my thoughts as we go. But if you think about the German cake looking a bit like a palace, you said, but I'm thinking of German castles, you know, the fairy tale castles.
Yeah, oh my gosh, there was that as well. There was like, what was that place? Hanover. Like Hanover was like a Christmas card as well, you know, with the houses. I regret not learning a language. I've got to say that up front, because I think that I initially thought that I was the most important thing in the world that I was going to, because I was going to perform and I was going to, you know, I was going to get on stage and this was all new, and I loved everything, the cars driving on the wrong way of the road, the other side of the road. And this was before the wall came down as well. And that was the beginning of my hotel, train, plane, car, taxi life of travel, because it didn't stop then. That it began there, and it went all over the world and continues to, you know, this lockdown that we're in at present means that I've not gone to Dubai, I've not gone to Ethiopia to film, India, America, and a couple of other places, Australia. I should have been there promoting my book.
It must have been very strange, because you've gone from children's homes to pretty much instant success on the poetry scene and international travel. It's almost like there was no in-between.
Very much so. I was very defined about what I wanted to be, and it happened. I wanted to find my family, my mother, my birth mother, and I wanted to be the poet that I always knew I was. And it's funny, this travel, that I've been performing has paid for my other journey, my internal journey and physical journey to find my family. It really has.
Tell us about finding your family, because you did find your mother at age 21, was it?
I did, yeah. Yeah, and the resources that I used, strangely, when I left care also, I got a job as a literature development worker in Manchester at 19 years of age, you know. I used any money that I got really from poetry and from that post to put into the search for my mum. And I found her within 3 years of leaving the children's homes. She works for the United Nations. She was stationed in the Gambia. She had to flee Ethiopia in 1974 due to the emperor's being overthrown and the revolution that happened there. I flew for the first time to Africa at 21, the first time to the continent which I'd been stolen from. And I went to Senegal first. I booked the flight. Remember, I'm still in Lancashire, right? I'm based in Manchester now, but I'd never booked a flight before myself. People normally book flights for me, they still do to this day. And I sent the money to a travel agent in Brixton in cash, in an envelope. That's how much I didn't know, okay? Also, I had no family, so I had nobody to tell me not to do that. That's the whole story. But so I put the money in cash in an envelope and I sent it to, it begins with T, it was a travel agent in Brixton, to book me this flight. And they sent me a letter back to say, we received your money, don't send cash again like that ever in the post. And so I traveled to Senegal, and I had to stay there for a night, And yeah, and that's where I met an airport guy who worked at the airport, who he invited me to his family to go and eat. And I did. And then he found me a hotel close by. It was a terrible hotel. I mean, it wasn't even a hotel. It was probably somebody's house with a bedroom in it. I think that's what it was. But it was just what I needed.
What was it like going to eat with his family? Because
My gosh, I had jollof rice for the first time and fish, and it was beautiful. And, you know, the beautiful introduction to Africa was this guy and his family, and he was into Chris Rea, Lady in Red, you know. And that's the great thing about traveling, though, isn't it? It's you know, put down your stereotypes and put down your preconceptions and listen and watch and find and discover. You know, one of the most enjoyable things I find is not understanding other people's languages, because to communicate, I have to look at the face and the eyes and the context and the, and the hands. And you switch on a skill that lazily we don't really use that much, you know. And you have to drop your fear, because fear makes you feel that everybody's saying bad things about you, they don't care, blah, 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 blah. Switch on your humor face. Enjoy not knowing, you know. I love bartering, okay? And I love bartering because it's a game. And especially if you're not from round Dublin area. Always go disgustingly low. Okay, just go to a point where the person who's looking at you thinking, are you really suggesting that? Go offensively low. You know, because it's not offensive. It's kind
of fun. I
can't
go. It's been a long time since I've bartered. I feel bad about it because, you know, you do it in India or something and you realise that you're actually arguing over 5p or something, you know, when you translate it. But I think I go half and then sort of meet three quarters. So I'm obviously going wrong here, aren't I?
Go way lower than half because it's fun, you know. And I'm not talking about for fruit or food, or I'm not talking about bartering for that. That's not what I mean. I mean, if you're going to buy a rug, or if they saw you coming, and you know, people in the markets are the same anywhere in the world, you know, except for places that you go where like there is no such thing as bartering. And like if you barter there,
you get taken away somewhere.
Yeah.
I love it that you go, that you embrace, like, you know, you do get picked up from the airport and someone does take you to their house. That happened to me the first time I went to Fiji. And similar to you, I was going to Fiji to meet my family for the first time, my dad's family. And, you know, they take you back to the house. You're vulnerable. It's exciting. And it's also, for me, excruciatingly awkward, you know, because you're in someone's house and you don't speak the language and they're giving you food, and it's lovely. And it's those experiences that you look back on. And this is probably what I love so much about travel, is you put yourselves in these vulnerable, embarrassing, awkward situations, and afterwards they make the best stories. But at the time you're sitting there thinking, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know what to say.
I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know the rules. I don't know, should I be talking to this person to my left? You know, the first time I ate Ethiopian food with a group, because we, at times, not all the time, but you can eat together, you know, I was putting my hand over to get the food on the other side of the circle. I hadn't realized that every person has their own station of food. Do you know what I mean?
Ethiopian food is just the best. Honestly, I fell in love with Addis Ababa. I'd love to go back there and explore more. And the food is stunning, really stunning. But so you went to Senegal, and where you still haven't met your mum yet. So what happened?
Yeah, I went to Senegal, and then when we got the flight over from Senegal to the Gambia the next day, when I got the flight over alone, I was speaking to the person who sat next to me, a sort of Muslim guy, very large, sort of deep voice, kind face. And he said, those people at the back of the plane, they work with your mum. So this is the first introduction to my family. Now, My mother and my father's family are very international. They went to international schools in Paris and Belgium, and half my father's family studied, well, all of them studied in New York and in Washington, D.C., at Harvard and Berkeley, et cetera, et cetera. I had no idea about all of this. But this does fit with travel because... So then I went to the back of the plane and I said to these people, oh, my mum's in... Does my mum work with you? And they were like, yeah, she works at the UNDP offices. And she's from Ethiopia, but like I say, she was stationed in the Gambia. And so there was a black Mercedes waiting for them at the little airport in Banjul. Was it Banjul? And on the tarmac. And they put me in the car and then they just drove into the Gambian dusk. The golden wings of dust flying from the side, each side of this black panther, you know, pelting through the night. And one by one, the UN officers were dropped off and they had a word with the driver, because who was I, really, you know, to check first. And he took me to Fajara. Fajara was the part of the Gambia where the diplomats lived and the embassy people and what have you. It's by the coast. Very different now, by the way. You know, a lot has happened in the Gambia regarding tourism and little bits of trouble here and there. The Mercedes parked outside of these tall manicured hedges which hid the pathway that then led up to the house. And I heard her coming and opening the gate after speaking to the driver, and that's where I hugged her. And then she took me into the house, and that's where I stayed for a week and a half.
What was it like meeting your mum?
It was okay. It was actually quite awkward, I think, for her and for me, and so we've got a lot of navigating to do in our relationship. And it's amazing, isn't it, how much travel works its way into our language and our journeys. Journeys, we talk of journeys, don't we, in life. We navigate through problems, as I was just saying with my mum, you know. We find pathways, you know. We take flight. So I'm still navigating my way with my mum 30 years after that moment. And I think that means that I've probably got a relationship like most people have got in their own families. We're all trying to get our parents to see us for who we think we are. And we're all trying to find conversations with our family members and finding that we can't speak fully with one, but we will learn to, or we will learn to accept that we won't be able to speak in the way we want to with one family member, you know. And we sort of solidify at times. And I think I've been, you know, able to accept that maybe the people I met in my family, they're hurt in different ways. The revolution happened in Ethiopia. They all had to fly around the world. By the way, many of them worked for Ethiopian Airlines. So the airline has actually been part of the story inside my DNA, even the airline as a symbol of Ethiopia, which it was in the 1960s. And early 70s being the catch me if you can generation. It's best shown in the film Catch Me If You Can,
yeah,
by Leonardo DiCaprio. That walk of the pilot and the air hostesses, as they were called then, walking beside him through the airport, is everything about what airlines were in the world. It was a village, the airline world. the training from TWA in America to Ethiopian Airlines meant that Ethiopian Airlines was known amongst pilots around the world as being a top standard, top flight. Talk about that, don't we? We say, oh, it's top flight. A top flight airline known to the industry. It's not a village anymore, but it was then.
The lady I went to interview in Addis Ababa, Leah Kabide, a top model.
Yeah, I know Leah. Yeah.
Wonderful lady. And her father worked for Ethiopian Airlines, yeah. as did the father of Maza Mengistu.
She's amazing. I went to
New York to interview her and Marcus Samuelson, all these Ethiopians in the diaspora, as they call it, you know, out and about doing their own thing. But the interesting thing about Leah is she said growing up in Addis Ababa, they were very middle class, you know, a bit like your family sounding. And people assume that your mum came to and gave birth in England. They assume that like they're living in huts or poverty. You know, I have that a bit with my family. And Leah also said that she didn't realise she was black until she left Ethiopia and went to live in Paris, because she was just a person, you know, in Ethiopia. And then suddenly she was, you know, othered as soon as she went to live in a European country. But it reminded me of the time I went to meet my family. I grew up in the north of England and in Spain as well, with a white English mum and a dad who's an Indian Fijian. And my dad is the only brown person I've ever met that I was related to, and obviously it's me and my brother. The very first time I went to Fiji, the very first time I met another brown person in my family, you know, I was looking at his face. It was my cousin Ben. And I was actually waiting in the hotel lobby for him to come in. And every single person that came to the door, I smiled, like, because, you know, this could be my uncle. I have no idea what he looks like. Actually, Ben is my cousin. But then, like, to look at his face and to see, like, my dad in all these people, when there had only been my dad, whether for you, there had only been you. So what was that like, looking at your mother's face? It just must have been astounding.
Yeah, and like you, I met my brothers and sisters, I met my cousins, but I had a similar experience as the one you've just explained when seeing my brothers and sisters and the sons and daughters of my mother. And it's a strange and very unique experience that you've just outlined, and very beautiful as well, because you know people are always saying to me, like, you know, you're black or you're this or you're that, and it's fine, you know. So I will you know, tell myself I am black. I'm also a human being. I'm also a collection of molecules. I'm also an artist. I'm also a northern lad. I'm also a Londoner, because I live in London. I'm also a citizen of England. I am a citizen. I am a born from Ethiopia, son of Ethiopia. I'm all of those things. You know what I mean? And I might deny one day and think, oh, I'll have the other one today. You know, we're so tied to other people's definitions, and actually we don't have to be. You know, our choice is to define ourselves as people of the world, man. You know, I said earlier on that, you know, your first migration is from the womb into the open air, you know, and we're constantly migrating, and nobody wants a child to just go to university and then come back home and stay behind the curtains and look through the windows. You know, parents will watch their children grow wings and fly. So, you know, in that situation of constant travel, really, to see somebody who looks like you is like catching a leaf in a storm, you know, and going, wow, look at that. This is, you know, you're part of this world that I'm part of, and you look like me, or you look like somebody I know. You know, there is a joy in that. I've got to say that I've come to this recently. I think when you travel, you do come to things. It doesn't make you better. But I notice that people only call themselves by a colour when they're in the minority. So when a, quote, white person goes to Africa, they're like, oh, yeah. Or to the continent of Africa, they go, oh yeah, I'm a white guy. I understand, I'm a white guy. But when they're in England, where they're the majority, they're like, why are you defining me by my colour? Why are you saying white guy? It feels weird. When, oh, sorry, I've got upstairs stuff going on. When you go to Africa, if you call somebody black, they're like, whoa. You know, it feels reductive. So I just find that a fascinating thing.
So tell me, oh gosh, the drilling. Tell me a little bit about your dad then.
Well, my dad, do you do Salamta?
The magazine, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's me. I interviewed, okay. Interviewed Marcus Samuelson, Maza and Leah for it. But at the moment, it's all paused.
Okay. I'll tell you.
You were the next person. I told you when I contacted you on Facebook. You were the next person on our list to be interviewed. And Salamta is in the Ethiopian Airlines magazine, for anyone who doesn't know, because why would you know unless you fly on it regularly? And it's a lovely magazine, and that's where I was flying to Ethiopia and New York to interview these people for the magazine. I interviewed them and wrote it up for the magazine, and also we did a podcast with it, which I think is a great idea because airline magazines are going to be a thing of the past. You know, all those pages that people are touching on airlines. However, airline podcasts where people can listen, I mean, let's do more of those and obviously, you know, give me more work, you know. But yeah, you were going to be the next person on my list. You were.
I would say that is a great idea, the podcast idea. And I'll just tell you why. So I'm not just blowing smoke here, but Ethiopian Airlines has followed my journey back to Ethiopia. So I may have found my mum when I was 21, but I only first went to Ethiopia when I was 29, when I found out who my father was. And I made a BBC documentary about him. I have an incredible photograph of my father at the top of air stairs. You know, the stairs that go to the aeroplane, of course you know, but I'm just saying for the listener, the air stairs.
Well, do you know what? I've never heard the term air stairs before, even as a travel professional, but I could connect the dots. And I imagine right. That air stairs were the stairs going
Thank
up
you.
To the aeroplane.
And at the top, there's no aeroplane. There's just my dad and one of the emperor's lions. It is the most incredible photograph.
A lion, an actual lion.
A lion. If you Google now, if you've got your Google, if you put Lemcise father lion.
Lion, randomly.
Let's do this live.
Yeah, let's do
this
it.
Live okay, now. On. I mean, I could do it and
Lemcise father. Lion. That's the first thing that comes up. You know, you were predicted.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I'm going to steal that from my Instagram when we plug
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that an incredible picture? That's one of the Emperor's lions. If you look further down, you'll see a picture of my father with one of the, an Ethiopian Airlines plane. All my family are there, all working for Ethiopian Airlines.
Oh, there's an incredible picture, actually. I've just seen of you and your foster parents and...
Yes.
The little blonde kids and you. It's interesting.
If you see, you can also see, there's also a picture there of my father on the 25th anniversary of Ethiopian Airlines with a 25th anniversary cake with the American pilot who trained a lot of the pilots in Ethiopia at Ethiopian Airlines.
What was that? Lion, you know, why? Do you know?
Well, my father co-piloted the Emperor, so it could have been connected to do with that. But I actually don't know the story, actually, to be honest. I don't know the story, I just know. And there's another picture you'll see of my father in all of his Ethiopian Airlines, I think it's an official photograph. And on his finger is the exact same ring that Bob Marley has got on his finger.
But you never got to meet him. You never got to meet your father because he died in a plane crash.
I never got to meet my father.
Tell me what happened to him. I know you said he died in a plane crash. What do you know about that?
Well, I made a BBC television documentary in 1995, which was also the first time that I'd flown to Ethiopia on Ethiopian. My father passed away in a storm on New Year's Day, traveling from Ethiopia to Eritrea, from Addis to Asmara, in the Simien Mountains. And I took a film crew to the place where the crash happened, and I took my sister, my new sister, and we found pieces of plane sort of still 29 years, no, longer. It's 1974 to 1995, 50 years later. The side of the mountain has trees that have grown, that have pushed around the fuselage. You know, you, on one level, you look at the side of the mountain and you, this field, and you, it looks green, grey, and then as you look closer, you realise it's metal, pieces of metal all over that have been sort of smothered by the overgrowth, but that are still there. And as we went into the village of a very rural area, we saw that some of the doors of the very basic huts, homes, were from the plane, metal from the plane. Bowls that were used were metal from the plane, you know.
How did it feel seeing the place where your father lost his life? How did that feel?
I said in the film that it's like having found his place of rest was like beginning the rest of my life, you know. So it felt very good, you know, to have found him. And I actually went to the offices at Ethiopian Airlines, and I always think I missed out, because my brothers and sisters, they all got free airline tickets for the first 21 years of their lives. I've always wanted Ethiopian Airlines to say, yes, Lem, you deserve this.
backdated payment. Absolutely. I know people in the airline. I'll give them a call. They know you as well.
So. Yeah, they do. But they're so wonderful to me. Like, I stay at the Hilton in Addis because I love staying at the Hilton, and maybe that makes me, you know, it's one of your diaspora tickets, you know, stays at the Hilton. But I like it. It's where my father partied, and it's where my mother married her husband, who was the Vice Minister to Finance under the Emperor. It's where they partied, actually. She married at the Coptic Church there in Ethiopia.
So where do we go after this in terms of travel? I mean, obviously, it's a big fast forward. You travel all around the world in usual circumstances.
Oh, my gosh. I've been to so many incredible places and stayed in so many beautiful, beautiful hotels. Last year, I was in Bali, and I stayed at the, I think it was called the Amandi Hotels. And the year before, I'd stayed there, and the guy in the other room was Nick Cave. So they weren't rooms. They were like dedicated apartments. And you looked out of, you would draw back the wooden shutters. And you'd be looking directly into the side of a valley, a forest, basically. And at the back of the apartment, you would bathe in a stone, beautiful marble, sunken bathtub underneath the stars. It was all laid out so that it was everything that you wanted, but it was underneath the stars, and it was just the most luxurious, beautiful place.
Hang on, what's Nick Cave like on holiday? Because I used to live in Brighton, and I'll be returning there very soon. And yeah. Nick Cave was there. I think he's actually left now, but he had he was there a long, long time, probably still has a place there. And he has a beach hut on the front. And so often you'd be walking down Hove Seafront and you'd see Nick Cave sitting outside his beach hut, you know, with his deck chair, with his like sort of pointy black, you know, kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Resting up on another deck chair, and you'd think, this is so incongruous seeing like Nick Cave. And also because he's so pale as well. I mean, what's he like on holiday? Did you have a little chat with him?
Well, he I've been down to a studio in Brighton, by the way, in Hove, I think it was.
Yeah.
But he was the same, the full black. I have actually a mental image of him stood outside of his apartment, which was next to mine, but far enough away for it to be totally private. This was top end, looking out at the valley, which you could basically almost touch. It was a big drop that was full of green that stretched up. You know, it's so lush. Yeah, and the contrast of this black, wily, sort of wiry figure with, yes, the pointy shoes and the looking out against this lush, verdant green sort of burned into my memory. But he was quiet, he was with his partner, and so, yeah, having a private good time. He was the patron of the festival, of the gig that I was doing out there. So there's oh gosh, Singapore performing in the Botanic Gardens on the stage, which is like an open oyster shell shape, and performing to the man-made hills that served as an auditorium, auditorium.
You're thinking amphitheatre, aren't you? That's the
amphitheatre.
Yeah,
thank
amphitheatre,
you.
Amphitheatre, that's it, yeah.
But, and in front of the stage, before you got to the hill where people were, the amphitheatre sort of effect that people were sat on, was a small sort of half lake with black swans on it while performing on stage over the lake, over the black swans, to the audience who were sat on this sort of like amphitheatre hill that was crowned by trees. It was the perfect, you know, idyllic thing. And then obviously Dubai is a very strange experience, but wonderful.
Where have you felt most at peace?
I think it's always Ethiopia for me. I think, oh, well, strangely enough, Scotland, the Highlands, Loch Inver, the sort of barren Highlands. They're not barren, but it's funny, isn't it? The place that people often think of as barren are often not so once you look under the surface. But no, I think Ethiopia, I feel very at home in. I love New York. I like the people. I think the people, you know, when anybody says, they're like, oh, I love there because of the food. Like I was in, where was I not so long ago? In Malaysia, in Penang. It's like, oh, they're like, the food's great. Whenever you say the food worked great, whenever I say the food's great, I try and add to it, it's the people that make the food. You know, the food is a reflection of the people. And it's really important to make that connection, because otherwise we are sort of stealing. We say, oh, this food is good. It's like going to somebody's house, isn't it? And just saying, oh, yeah, the food's good, and eating it all, and then walking out of the house. You know what I mean? You say that, so it's always worth remembering, the food is good, the people, either the people are incredible or the people must be incredible to make food like this.
That's a really lovely way of thinking of it, and I never thought of it like that. You have a very, this is very obvious, but you have a very poetic nature. You are a poet, but you do have a very poetic nature and a beautiful way of expressing things. And actually, I saw a quote from you that really resonated, and you know, when we talk about, I've never made that connection before, when we talk about the journey and top flight and navigating and sailing as well. We sail
the way forward.
The way forward. All of these travel, what do we call them?
Metaphors. It becomes a metaphor, you know, a symbol. The travel actually populates our language.
Yes, I've never made that connection, and it took you as a poet to make that connection. But this quote that I thought, something that you said, you know, you left care and that childhood so long ago, but you've actually said that you never leave it behind, and part of you is always that rootless kid. Now, you seem a very happy rootless kid, but do you think that rootlessness has almost given you wings, another travel metaphor?
Yeah, absolutely. I think something tells me I would have been this way. You know, I don't think that I am this way because of what happened to me. I think there's something about who I am that is just who I am. You know, yeah, I really do think that. And I mean, there is something that, there's something also to be said for staying at home. That you can have the greatest journeys in your own village, you know, and I think that we who travel a lot, we actually probably meet quite a lot of people who don't travel a lot. And actually, I hope that I see the value in those people who know their home, are happy with the world to be what it is, and stay put. And they read books, and they travel in much, you know, just as interesting ways, which are just as interesting as the way of the traveler. You know, I think it's really important for us to see each other, you know, and that's what traveling is about. But it's also what being at home is about, you know, that's available to all people. Does that sort of make sense? But if there was one gift I could give to kids in care and inner city kids, I mean, I'm a country boy, but I live in the city, it's travel. It's travel. And they say that travel broadens the mind, but it's the new experience that broadens the mind, I think, you know. It's realizing, oh, your way of thinking of the world is not the only way. It's not that you're wrong, it's just it's not the only way, you know.
Absolutely. So before I ask you my last question, is there anything you think I've missed? I mean, there's so many things, but anything
here? No, it's not gone the way I thought it would go, which is good.
I do like to talk about the philosophy of travel and what travel means, and it's not necessarily where I went on my holidays, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, there was something. Yeah, I think it was connected to the fact that we're all immigrants, and we're all of us. I think that migration is part of what it is to be human. Traveling is part of what it is to be human. You know, the scientists will tell you that the oldest human beings were in Ethiopia, discovered, I think, in the 1970s. We've been traveling out from where we live ever since then. Our children migrate from adolescence to adults, from single to married, from house to house, you know, from village to city, from city back to village. These are all migrations, you know. We look at the television, we watch animals, and we think, oh, wow, look at them. The reason that we're doing that is because we're part of that process, you know. It is a celebration of what it is to be a human. No, we don't ask our children to grow up and stay still. You know, unfortunately, we watch them grow wings and fly. You know, it's part of who we are. We hope they fly back every now and again, and they do.
It's funny saying this at a time like this, isn't it? Where all of those things have been taken away from us, where the kids, when in some countries they've been locked in the house completely, when people aren't going to university and coming back, or going to school and coming back, or even in some cases going to work and going back. But another thing that rang true is what you said about travel. When we travel, we're often meeting people who aren't traveling at all.
It's good for us because it asks humility, you know, and understanding. Yeah.
My last question is always about music, because I believe that music and travel very much go hand in hand. And if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and why?
The song that I would like to choose is Cold by Annie Lennox. And I listen to that on my headphones on the beach in the Gambia while looking at the Atlantic Ocean.
Was that the first time you went to meet your mum?
Yes, it was the first time I went to meet my mum. Yeah, it's all in the lyrics of that song. Run to me, come with me, do and be done with me. Cold, cold, cold. Yeah, the words say it all.
Thank you so much for that, Lem. And also, I love this job, I really do. How amazing to speak to such a fascinating man about his life and work. Next episode, we have the equally brilliant Lloyd Grossman, who I have to admit was much more than the light entertainment star I thought I knew.